Music, that's so great. That's Ali Farka Touré on guitar with Toumani Diabaté, both of them from Mali. Of course, Ali Farka Touré has passed on, but both these musicians are like the luminaries of wonderful traditional and new music, as it were, from Mali. Diabaté is on Kora, and you heard the wonderful Orlando Cachaito Lopez from Cuba on bass. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, June the 21st, and mass demonstrations in major cities of Brazil, now seeing the participation of millions of Brazilians, having forced a rollback on public transportation hikes, continue to press the sympathetic Workers' Party government of Dilma Rousseff to fight corruption and raise a standard of living for the country's working class and poor. In Sao Paulo, the country's largest state, one person was killed last night in a clash with police. It was the first death associated with the demonstrations, which continue to build. And on the home front, it's Let's Make a Deal on immigration reform. But behind the congressional theatrics of immigration reform is a rogues agreement between Republicans and Democrats promising everything they could promise. But the fact is that built into this immigration reform bill is planned delays and frustrations. They'll find that down the road a bit. The idea is to delay gratification. This is not an instant gratification program, certainly not for Mexicans. It is immediate gratification for a whole other set of interests. But they will hold up the Mexicans as a shield. We're doing this in the interest of immigration, to give people a good and even and fair square break. But we'll talk about that today. And of course, later in the program, we'll talk about George Zimmerman, who has already scored a major victory, but it's not even being discussed, which is why, of course, we'll talk about it here. Interesting, yesterday, great reaction, and I thank you for it, as we denuded nativism. You know, that's our new word. We nativism. It so upset this guest. I mean, he went bonkers, actually forbidding me on my own program not to use the word nativism. So you know how you punish somebody like that? You put them in a cell and you just have the word nativism recorded 500 million times and just play it constantly 24/7, and that ought to drive him absolutely bonkers. But that, I told you, was really a natural byproduct of this immigration reform. As we speak, Vice President Joe Biden is in Las Vegas making nice with the Latinos. Gathered in Las Vegas are about 1,100 people attending the National Conference for the League of United Latin American Citizens. And, of course, wherever two or more are gathered in somebody else's name, there you will find a politician. And Vice President Biden is there in Las Vegas, And he has already said, "What is it that you think we're working on?" He asked him the question. The question you should ask is, "What will immigration reform do for America?" he said. Yesterday. "The answer is clear and resounding," he said. "It can and will do things for America, great things for America. It will put Latinos on a, quote, fair and firm and unfettered path for 11 million people to become U.S. citizens." And, of course, the crowd roars and all of that. Here's the deal that you need to understand about immigration reform. It is, in a way, a very, how do I describe this? It's a really disgusting plan, but you know, that's basically what makes it so typically political. The Obama administration has made a great deal out of this. We talked about the fact that this constituency was a constituency that voted as a block for Barack Obama, especially in his reelection, his current term, and overwhelmingly so, to the point that it is actually seen now as a, quote, legitimate, unquote, farm of people that should be brought into somebody's fold. Being that the Democratic candidate was the one who supposedly lit this fire, this political fire, the Democratic Party believes that this group belongs to the Democrats. So the effort is to bring them into the party. Why? Because they can use all the help they can get, not only in Congress, but across the nation in other offices as well, governors, for example, and local offices. But particularly, they would like to have a greater command of control in the House and Senate, and that's been President Obama's major priority. The Republicans saw in this past election the opportunity that they blew, big time they blew it. The Latino community was there all along. And before a heavy, heavy concentration by the Democrats on bringing this group into the fold, the Republicans could have done so. It could, the party could have been the place for Latinos to go, but they just were not interested. They were, you know, they had a monovision. It was a white bread America. And they have admitted since then that they've blown it. They blew it big time. But now under immigration reform, both parties are energized to do something because both parties feel that they have equal shots at this Latino constituency. And so the Democrats have used immigration reform, and it historically did it. It was out front about this issue before the Republicans, but the Republicans have caught on, and they have said, listen, we also offer an alternative, and under immigration reform, we can do a bunch of things that would be of benefit to you. So don't discount us. For the Latinos, it's a wonderful thing because now they have options. They can certainly pull the Democratic Party's chain, and they can make themselves, you know, available to the Republican Party. So this is how these political interests tie in. But here's the deal. The Latinos are interested in the big prize. The big prize now is the quote, path to citizenship. It's been the prize. But here's what's going on. The Democrats and the Republicans see a wonderful opportunity to do politics the old-fashioned way. And so all of this talk that you're hearing about the deals that have to be struck and the concern about border security and all of this stuff, what they're really discussing is how much money right now at this time under immigration reform. Yes, it's about green cards and it's about permanent residency and ultimately citizenship. It's about all those things. But it also is about making money. And the way politicians make money is they try to figure out what kinds of projects they can bring home, especially on the eve of, you know, the midterm elections, and after that, just 2 years to the presidential elections of 2016. What can we do with this opportunity to bring home some bacon, make some money? So now you will be hearing a lot about border security. So they came up with this ingenious strategy. The strategy is we shouldn't give them anything right off the bat. No amnesty, no, don't give them anything. Give them the carrot, dangle the carrot of a path to citizenship. It will come eventually. And as I told you before, this program, that is 13 years they will have to wait. And then so after that 13-year wait, it's provisional because those people wishing to become citizens will now have to go through a whole set of permutations, and they'll have to be investigated, and they'll have to pay fines, and they'll have to pay fees and all of that stuff. So you're talking about 13 years down the road. But right now, if they go with the other items that can be thrown into this thing, and they already have, that's what the negotiation is about. Let me give you an example. The president, as you know, has not yet been able to formulate an economic plan for the nation to combat unimaginable unemployment rates. He's just not yet done that. The Republicans, with this immigration issue, can now actually unleash their own economic initiative. How? For example, there are 700 miles of new fencing to be built because that's what they're saying now. We have to secure the border. It's not about securing the border. Everybody is in favor of securing the border, but there's never been money for it. So now they have decided we are going to push the border security issue. And how are you going to argue that your borders should not be secure? How are you going to argue that? So now that's been a wonderful deal that they got. 700 miles of fencing to be built. That's a jobs program. And guess what? Barack Obama has not been able to generate the kinds of jobs and opportunities under his administration, which is now almost 5 years old. So the Republicans would say, under the immigration reform and border security, 700 miles of fencing to be built. That's big. And then we, of course, once we have our borders up, we're going to have border patrol officers. So there will be at least 40,000 border patrol officers. And then you're going to have to beef up security at airports and seaports. That's more people going to work. So in effect, the Republicans will be using immigration reform as their own demonstration project for a works project. It's going to look like immigration reform, but that's what they're fighting over. So when you hear about border security, It is about jobs. The Democratic president has not had a single idea of how to produce jobs. The Republicans have come up with a nifty little plan, and it is going to work. You will, when you're building 700 miles of new fencing, you're talking about a huge project that will take you way past 2014, 2016. That's what they're doing. Now, this would enable the Republicans to say to their respective constituencies, we have done well. We have secured the borders, which the Democratic administration did not do and could not do. We have succeeded in doing that. And look how many jobs they have generated. You see? Now, for this plan to work, they have to hold the Mexicans hostage, because the plan is as good as long as the Mexicans don't get their prize. So they will, that's the 13-year wait. They will milk this thing until they can't get another drop out of it. And this is why I'm saying this is, in a sense, a really nasty, racist calculation that says to a group that has been so differently treated as a group with respect to the issue of immigration. And this is why I said the fatal mistake that Barack Obama made was so racializing the issue. Of course, Mexicans in this round of immigration, it happens that Mexicans are the largest contingent of immigrants into the United States. But just another 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, immigration essentially was a European issue. This is the nature of the world. These issues didn't become so socially demanding and immediate until the complexion started to change. And the influx of Mexicans into the United States has a great deal to do with U.S. foreign policy, the NAFTA agreement, the dislocation of the Mexican economy itself as a result of, you know, the move of American corporations to, it's called the Maquiladora, they move close to the border, disrupt the economy of Mexico. People leave what they were doing, thinking that they'll get better pay with these jobs with American companies. And then you had the consequences of all of that that Mexico is reeling from right now. You had the drug issues, violence, corruption, and so forth. But I thought I would point this out to you, because this is the kind of disdain, the kind of disrespect. It is looking so beneficent. It is looking so wonderfully magnanimous that the administration wants to help Mexican people. Help them. And of course, all the wonderful laudatory things are being said. This is the land of immigrants and all of that kind of stuff. They do not intend to bring Mexicans into this nation in one fell swoop. It was never the plan. I pointed that out. This, they will wait at least 13 years. And by the way, here's the flip side of that. We want all these people in. The Obama administration, you may be interested to know, is the most deporting administration in the history of all presidents of the United States. So he's there saying to people, we want you in. People don't say, well, how many people are you kicking out? The answer is close to 2 million people by the end of this year. That's huge. The Obama administration has ratcheted up the deportation process and the constitutional violations that go along with that. We have many people sitting, for example, in Miami and other places all over the country, sitting in detention, not because they've committed crimes, but because their status has not yet been established, and they are here, quote, illegally, unquote, but they have not committed, other than that, any crimes. Many people are here from other countries looking for asylum, looking for refuge, and their cases remain pending for a long time, 2, 3, 4 years. But this administration, this wonderful liberal administration, has deported more people than any president in the entire history of the United States. So, let me come back and summarize this thing, because I say this to you as a kind of hint about when things are made to look what they really are not. They're made to look like what they really are not. It is made to look like a wonderful thing, bestowing citizenship, bringing people in. They have hopes and dreams and aspirations like anybody else. And this is, after all, a land of immigrants and all the wonderful good things that were said. But there is a seedy, nasty underside to it, and it's racist to the core. And in this particular instance, this is how both sides are treating a particular constituency, one by virtue of the fact that they are non-white Hispanics, as they call them, and number two, they are a new political entity and still, therefore, subject to attack. But if the Mexican and Latino communities were smart about this thing, they would recognize that in the middle of all of this, they have extraordinary power. And here is where coalition politics can be extremely useful as a tool. They needed to band together with other groups, and they need to work closer with other groups to fortify their political defenses, which will make them entitled to make demands, because they also are in a position to make demands. If it were decided tomorrow among the Mexican community that they're just walking, they don't want to hear from the Republicans, they don't want to hear from the Democrats, they'll wait and see what happens in 2016, you will see how fast political decisions would be made to get them processed. And in the meantime, here's the flip side of the coin. While the Mexicans will have to wait at least 13 years, the high-tech industries, whose CEOs and, you know, their captains have contributed mightily to the Democrats, as well as the Republicans, but more so the Democrats, they get their special visas right off the top. The visas that they want, while the Mexicans are waiting, their people will be coming in under all these different kinds of visas quickly and guaranteed. You see? So this is how corrupt the situation is. I point this out because I think we ought to have a real conversation about this. And yesterday, when the guest, who turned out to be quite a package, when I said the word nativism, it so angered him, because that's exactly what it is. Everybody gets a piece of their agenda satisfied on this issue, and this issue literally is being carried, it's loaded up on the backs of the Mexican immigrants. They're carrying all of this. They're not yet benefiting from one thing, but they are at the center of a whole lot of money and the American imperative to remain in charge. Because among other things, the great threat comes in 2043. In fact, as of this month, the threat has begun to be real. Why? Because for the first time in the history of the United States, more whites have died than were born. That speaks to the transition that is inevitable by 2043, which is that white Americans will be the new minority. It officially began. Now, it's not made a whole lot of noise about it, but believe me, these things are reverberating like you would not believe. This is shaking the psychological foundations of this country. How do you wrap your brain around the idea that you are now a, quote, minority? It is so alien a concept. It's never been dealt with before. And if you're going to be a minority, my God, be a minority to Mexicans and African Americans? Oh, heck no. See? So that is the honest discussion that we have to have. I'm going to take a break here and come back and talk about Mr. Zimmerman right after these messages about wonderful PRN.FM. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Okay, so you know, of course, that a jury has been chosen to hear the case against George Zimmerman, who is charged with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. The jury consists, the six-member jury consists of five white females. It's an all-female jury. And one female who the media says they can't really decide whether she is, quote, Hispanic or some other admixture thereof. It's amazing that part of what we have to consider is not your ability to be impartial as a juror, but your race and your racial attitudes and your racial history as part of justice. But bear in mind, as a trial begins against George Zimmerman on second-degree murder charge, that he already has won a huge victory that has not been discussed very much. And that is, he actually should be facing first-degree murder charges. And how he ended up facing second-degree murder charges is a question that some major law investigative body should be taking a look at. And they should have taken a look at that a long time ago. George Zimmerman entered a police precinct or a station house handcuffed. That's the first you saw of him, he was handcuffed. What does that mean? It means he's under arrest. When handcuffs are placed on you, you are under arrest. And when a person is under arrest, there is a particular series of things that begin to happen. You're under arrest. You are immediately brought before some judge or magistrate. And there is a charge, even though preliminary, but there's a charge. But George Zimmerman was brought in. That is to say, he was arrested, which is to say that at the time he was arrested, The police officers making the arrest had reason to believe he had committed a crime. So we have not yet had the explanation as to how and why George Zimmerman, brought in as an arrestee, left the station house with no handcuffs, and he went on his merry way, not seeing a magistrate, not having to make any kind of statement with respect to the crime. That's a huge victory. But how did it happen? To this day, we have no explanation as to how it is a person arrested, and not for, you know, stealing candy from the candy store, a person arrested in a crime where a homicide has occurred, a person who had said he was the cause of the homicide, he did the shooting, comes in arrested, the police therefore having reason to believe he was connected to the crime, he walks out of the station house a free man, and then goes into hiding. So now it ups the ante. He's not only a suspect in a murder at that time, he now becomes a fugitive. George Zimmerman has never been charged as a fugitive. He never was kept for questioning, further questioning. He never was brought before a magistrate. He was never brought before any officer of the court to make any statement with respect to the crime, to which he freely admitted he was the reason for the death of Trayvon Martin. Now, those are huge political victories and legal victories right there. And it seems to me that somebody, I mean, defendants don't just get up and walk out of a jail. Somebody allowed that to happen. Who was that person, or who are those persons? So he is incredibly powerful as an individual to have been arrested for a crime involving a homicide, to be brought into the station, which is the expectation of police. I mean, this is normal. You pick up a suspect, he's a confessed killer. I did it. I had to shoot him because whatever it is, it doesn't matter at that time. You have a person who said, I killed him. You put handcuffs on him, bring him down. How come he doesn't go through the process? Who made that decision? The case is going along as if, well, it's proceeding according to the law. What law? And here comes the other important victory. The other important victory is that he's being charged somehow. The charge of murder in the first degree does not apply. Well, how did that happen? It happened because the person appointed by the governor here to be this, quote, special prosecutor in this case, and I assure you there's nothing really special about this prosecutor, decided on her own, I don't think so. I don't think this is not a first-degree murder case. We'll go with second-degree murder. Well, no problem there. The problem is, that's not her decision to make. That is the decision of a grand jury to make. A grand jury decides what kind of charge should prevail against the defendant. She never brought this matter before a grand jury. This matter did not see a grand jury. Because it wasn't the intention from the beginning to give the grand jury a number of scenarios and to argue before the grand jury for the favored scenario under which the defendant should be charged. You see what I'm saying? The prosecutor herself committed a huge, this is so huge. This is bigger than the trial. Because this is prosecutorial misconduct in the extreme. The woman was never at the scene. She didn't interview anybody. She didn't do any police work herself. And besides which, the law does not allow her to decide unilaterally that a particular charge just doesn't make sense. The intention never was to consider first-degree murder charges against George Zimmerman, which is premeditated and which carries the death penalty, which is a capital crime. And that's why only 6 jurors, as opposed to 12, will be hearing this case. If it were a capital case, 12 jurors would have to hear this case. But this prosecutor just decided, behind her desk, completely removed from the scene and from the people involved and from the evidence and from everything else, she came up with this unilateral decision that George Zimmerman is not going to face first-degree murder charges. That, my friends, is huge. This matter was never brought before the grand jury to consider. For what reasons, we can only speculate. But there's no question that this is a glaring and blatant example of prosecutorial misconduct. I've seen this many, many, many times in many cases, including the Tawana Brawley case, the Central Park case. Almost every case, high-profile case like this, you have to assume somewhere that some kind of under-the-table arrangement is being made to frustrate justice. So come Monday, there will be the beginning of a trial on false pretenses. It is the grand jury's job. It is the grand jury's duty. It is the grand jury's authority and the grand jury alone. But the prosecutor should be presenting this smorgasbord of choices. It's the prosecutor's job before the grand jury to say, well, this is the range of charges, but we believe X, Y, and Z. This case did not see that process occur. Now, I'm telling you, this is how these cases go. And there will be a lot of charade, as there has been already, a lot of back and forth and media coverage, and the lawyers over here are saying this, and the lawyers over there are saying that, and big media coverage. And people are not looking at the clear and present problem. This is a bogus case. The two most important parts of this trial have not yet been addressed. How is it that a person arrested in a charge or in a crime involving homicide, brought in under arrest by police officers, manages to walk out of the precinct? I mean, he didn't run out. He just walked out quite confidently. and then went on the lam. He's never been charged with escaping. He's not an escapee or fugitive. Oh, no, no, no. How come? Could you imagine any African American or Latino male similarly situated? No. So that's my case, and that's where we are going starting Monday. We'll be talking about these fundamental flaws in this case. I tell you that it is happening in front of our eyes. So it looks legitimate. It looks correct. With all the brouhaha, it looks like justice is about to occur. We are about to see a just trial. And I'm saying to you today that George Zimmerman has already won major legal victories. And the third one I could mention as I come to the end of the program, he initially decided that he was going to defend himself under the aegis of the Stand Your Ground law, and then changed his mind, according to his lawyers. And there's a reason. Because even in the first instance, when he was first arrested, when the police themselves could not see rationale for Stand Your Ground elements in what they were learning about the case, George Zimmerman could not sustain a Stand Your Ground defense. Although I played a tape for you last week that said, although he is going to defend against the second-degree murder charge simply as self-defense, the lawyers are going nonetheless to bring in through the back door the Stand Your Ground defense. Because, frankly, they could not legally sustain the Stand Your Ground defense. All right, so I gave you a briefing. Do not say when the case starts next week that you don't have an alternative perspective on this thing. There is already prosecutorial misconduct occurring. It has occurred, and more than once in this case. George Zimmerman has already scored major, major legal victories. So don't be fooled. The second-degree murder charge, that's a piece of cake compared to what this omission has been, this legal omission that needs to be accounted for. Well, I want to thank you so much for putting up with me today. I wanted to say these things because, you know, as the immigration reform comes up, you will be hearing more and more of projects that are associated with a lot of money. And the president, who is in serious austerity mode, who is calling out the fact that he just doesn't see how we can sustain this level of spending as a country, will gladly put up almost $50 billion to get this piece of his political agenda off the ground. But this is like a bunch of vultures feeding on this political carcass. And wherever you see it, it's about money. So you will be hearing these projects have nothing to do with immigration per se, has nothing to do with the real benefits that the Mexican Americans and all immigrants are looking for. It's not to do with that. It has to do with how much money can people make out of this. And you will be hearing a lot of money coming up in respect to the immigration initiative. And certainly, again, as of Monday, you will be hearing, your attention will be drawn to the fact that you should only hear about a second-degree murder charge when George Zimmerman has already escaped justice, and more than once. So thank you for listening. Please take care of yourselves over the weekend, and join me back here on Monday. Bye-bye.